I'm going to go ahead and introduce Karen Omi and Sonia Crockett. They are providing the training today. Karen is the director of the Florida Clearinghouse on Supervised Visitation. She's given technical advice and training on visitation and access issues, written and co-authored many articles on supervised visitation issues, and she's the current chair of the Supervised Visitation Network Training Committee, among other accomplishments. Sonia Crockett, the name may sound familiar. She was part of the Guardian Ad Litem program in the Second Circuit from 1996 to 2001 and 2003 to 2005. So I will just let them take it away.
Thank you, Liz. This is Sonia Crockett, and I'm very happy to be part of the Guardian Ad Litem training today. And I'm going to talk to you for a bit about the Keeping Children Safe Act that became effective on July 1st, 2007. It creates a new section in Chapter 39, that's Section 39.0139. This act imposes additional requirements in the dependency process in an effort to keep sexually abused children from being abused further while in the system. The act targets parents, caregivers, and grandparents who have either been reported to the child abuse hotline for sexually abusing a child or who have been convicted of certain crimes, which I'll discuss in a moment. So once these persons have been identified, a rebuttable presumption is created that visitation or other contact with the person is detrimental to a child's safety, well-being, and physical, mental, and emotional health. Okay, so let's talk about the crimes that set up this rebuttable presumption. And these crimes, it doesn't matter whether the person has entered a no-contest plea or whether the court withheld adjudication, they still will trigger the provisions of this act. Sexual battery under Chapter 794, lewd and lascivious behavior under Chapter 798, lewdness and indecent exposure under Chapter 800, incest under Chapter 826, and then the general abuse of children, Chapter 827. Then finally, removing minors from the state or concealing minors contrary to court order, that's under Chapter 787. And although this doesn't deal directly with sexual abuse or sexually deviant behavior, I guess it was felt that anyone with a history of this type of behavior, of leaving a court's jurisdiction contrary to court order, might do it again. And in the dependency case, you wouldn't want that to happen. So that history of those crimes would create this rebuttable presumption. Also, designation as a sexual predator under Section 775.21 also creates this presumption of detriment, as well as the existence of a report to the child abuse hotline, which involves sexual abuse of any child, not just the child who's the subject of the dependency case before the court. Now, remember that this is a new law, and there may be some glitches in it that will have to be addressed next year by the legislature. For example, a hotline report which is closed with no indicators would still require further inquiry by the court. Also, while this act seems to target sexual abuse, the list of crimes that I just read to you, which create this presumption of detriment, includes the General Abuse of Children Statute, Chapter 827, which criminalizes non-support of children and misuse of child support money. Now, I question whether the requirements of 39.0139 should be activated when a parent has a conviction for non-support or misusing child support money. Now let's talk about the practical aspects of the law. You go into court this coming Monday morning for a shelter hearing. This could be the guardian attorneys or the case coordinators. At this point, only DCF will have any information about the child abuse hotline reports or the criminal history of any parent or caregiver who has been identified. Hopefully, the DCF attorney will inform the court as to whether any parent's history triggers the requirements of the Keeping Children Safe Act. But when I talked with one of the Second Judicial Circuit DCF attorneys earlier this week, he didn't know what I meant when I said the Keeping Children Safe Act. But when I began to explain the provisions, he said he had been provided information about the law. So if the DCF attorney or the judge doesn't bring up this issue, I hope that the guardian ad litem attorney will do so. Now, of course, you won't have the child abuse hotline reports or probably that FDLE criminal history, but you can alert the department attorney and the judge that these inquiries need to be made. Now let's say that the father has a conviction for sexual battery, according to the FDLE criminal history. At this point, the shelter order should be written to have a finding that the parent does have this FDLE criminal history of sexual battery, and at that point, further contact between the child and the parent should be prohibited until a hearing has been held to determine whether the child's safety, well-being, and physical, mental, and emotional health would be endangered by visitation or other contact with, in my hypothetical, the father, or it could be a mother, but in my hypothetical, I'm just saying the father. So, remember that the burden is on that father to prove by clear and convincing evidence that visitation is not detrimental to the child. If the father rebuts the presumption of detriment, the court should enter an order allowing visitation with any conditions the court finds necessary to protect the child. Now, if the father doesn't rebut the presumption of detriment, the court must enter a written order prohibiting or restricting visitation or other contact. Now, the court can prohibit it or can allow the visitation, but if visitation is allowed, it must either be supervised by a person who has previously received special training in the dynamics of child sexual abuse, or it should be conducted in a supervised visitation program. And I'm going to leave it to Karen Omi to talk about what kind of training the staff of the supervised visitation centers receive at this time. Now, let me make it clear that the new law says at the shelter hearing, if this rebuttable presumption is created, then a later hearing should be scheduled to allow that parent to try to present clear and convincing evidence to overcome that presumption. Okay, now, if at the later hearing the presumption is not overcome, is not rebutted, and visitation is allowed, and say grandmother wants to supervise that visitation, she can't do it now. So this is going to limit the pool of persons able to supervise the parent's visitation. But if there is a family member or a friend of the family, perhaps, who wants to be a supervisor and the guardian supports this idea, perhaps the supervised visitation center is limited in the number of cases they can take and doesn't have room for another case. If the guardian thinks that it's a good idea for this family member or other person to supervise the visitation, that person can be directed to the website of the Clearinghouse on Supervised Visitation, where there's an online training that covers the dynamics of child sexual abuse. After completion of the online training, a certificate of compliance can be printed from the computer. I suggest that a copy of that training be placed in the court file if indeed you're using a non-supervised visitation center supervisor. The website address for that online training is available in the materials that were emailed out yesterday. Okay, speaking of the training in the dynamics of child sexual abuse, this new act mandates that a guardian ad litem or an attorney ad litem must be appointed to all of these cases which trigger the requirements of 39.0139. And this guardian ad litem or attorney ad litem must have received training in the dynamics of child sexual abuse. The law does not say what the curriculum of such a training should be, but the state GAL program is working to ensure that the program complies with the law. I would think that any attorney ad litem who is appointed should at least have completed the online training provided by the Clearinghouse on Supervised Visitation. I talked with a legislative staff person who worked on this legislation, and she agreed that the idea was that the Clearinghouse on Supervised Visitation online training would be sufficient. And Karen and I were talking about whether an additional hearing will always be required when the criteria under 39.0139 are met. I can envision certain circumstances when that additional hearing would not be needed. For example, if the child abuse hotline report was closed with no indicators, it doesn't seem that another hearing would need to be scheduled. Or if the parent's criminal charge was for non-supportive dependence or misuse of child support money under Chapter 827, again, I don't see why the court should use additional court time to set a separate hearing. It could be handled at the shelter hearing. Over the coming months, I guess individual judges will be working their way through this new process, so we'll see. What additional problems arise. Please be aware that if any grandparent asks for visitation during the course of the dependency case, the same inquiries should be made. I believe the department already does a criminal history and abuse hotline check on anyone who has contact with a child under the court's jurisdiction. If a grandparent meets the criteria, the same presumption of detriment to the child arises, and the grandparent would not be able to have visitation or other contact until a hearing on the matter was held, and the grandparent presented clear and convincing evidence that the child would not be endangered by the contact or visitation. Guardians ad litem should be aware of the requirements of this law because they can incorporate questions into their investigation that might uncover convictions and child abuse hotline reports in other states. Family members are a good source of this information. However, I would advise that if such information is received from a family member, it should be confirmed by direct contact with the state's law enforcement agency or child welfare department before being presented to the court. The same inquiries about the existence of any of the listed criminal convictions or child sexual abuse hotline reports should be raised at the arraignment and the disposition hearings. There are two more situations addressed by this new law that the guardian ad litem staff and volunteers need to be aware of. The first concerns attempts to influence a child's testimony. Any party or participant who has firsthand knowledge that a person is attempting to influence the testimony of a child, or if this person has received that information from the child, so if the child tells you, "Mommy was trying to tell me what to say in court," that the guardian or whoever receives that information should inform the court that such activity is occurring. The court must then immediately suspend the visitation or other contact and schedule a hearing to determine whether it is in the best interest of the child to continue to prohibit the visitation or to restrict it in any way. Now, since guardians are usually in close contact with a child, I feel it's most likely to be the GAL who will have this sort of information. The guardian often observes the child with other people and might overhear a conversation where the guardian believes that the third party is trying to influence the child's testimony. So then the program attorney will need to file a motion pursuant to 39.0139, paren 6, and since this order will be issued without a hearing, an immediate hearing, I believe it would be good practice to have the guardian either sign an affidavit describing what he or she knows or to file a sworn motion along with an order that immediately suspends the visitation. And then the guardian ad litem attorney should follow up to make sure a full hearing is scheduled within a reasonable time. The new statute doesn't put any time limits on this hearing, but I would hope that the guardian ad litem wouldn't let it go too long because someone's visitation with that child has been cut off without a full evidentiary hearing or without any evidentiary hearing other than that motion that's been filed. The second additional situation addressed by the law is one in which a child who's been sexually abused is receiving therapy for that abuse, and the child's therapist reports that visitation or other contact is impeding the child's therapeutic progress. In that case, the court must convene a hearing within 7 business days to review the terms, conditions, or appropriateness of continued visitation or other contact. So this second one is different from the first one because the visitation is not immediately cut off without the hearing, but a hearing must be scheduled within 7 business days. Again, I believe it will most likely be the GAL who is in close contact with the child's therapist and will receive the therapist's concerns about the continuing visitation with the parent or other caregiver. The guardian ad litem should ask the therapist to put those concerns in writing and attach it to a motion to review visitation and get that hearing set within 7 days. Okay, unless Karen has other questions for me, I'll turn it over to her, but I do have a question for her first. Let me see if she has questions for me.
Well, I just have one question, Sonia. Do you think that because of this new law that there's going to be a flood of new sexual abuse allegation cases?
I really don't think so for a couple of reasons. I think that a parent who is going to use the child abuse hotline to hurt or to get back at another parent by filing a sexual abuse allegation is going to do that anyway. This law is new. It would take a sophisticated parent to understand that, oh, if I file that child sexual abuse allegation or hotline report, that's going to trigger yet another hearing for the other parent to have to go to, another hoop for them to jump through. So I don't see it opening up floodgates for a lot of new cases. But what I wanted to ask you, Karen, is, okay, I understand that people who supervise these sexually abused children have to have the special training in the dynamics of child sexual abuse, but why does this law contain the provision that guardians ad litem must be trained in the dynamics of child sexual abuse?
And that's a very good question, Sonia. And I know there's a lot of people listening in on the line who may have the same question. And the answer is an answer that you've probably heard discussed in lots of different kinds of dependency cases. It's that the families that that guardians ad litem interact with often have a constellation of problems. They very rarely only have the one problem that brought them into the dependency system, the one beating that was reported, the bruises that the teacher found. They often have, as the guardians start doing their jobs, investigating and digging around in the case, they start finding other things. They start finding, indeed, domestic violence. They find substance abuse. And they can also find sexual abuse. Now, I'm not saying that that would be in a majority of the cases. It would be in a minority, a small percentage of the cases, but it still exists. And the child deserves a guardian and, indeed, guardian attorneys and guardian staff members and caseworkers who understand the dynamics of child sexual abuse so that it's not invisible in the case. And you've probably, as you've taken the training that I know is mandated on domestic violence, you've heard a lot about some similarities that exist in child sexual abuse cases and in domestic violence cases. And we know that domestic violence exists in a very large portion of dependency cases. But sexual abuse, like domestic violence, is a crime that's committed in private. There's a very large taboo that exists about sexual abuse as well as domestic violence, but even more so in child sexual abuse cases. It's one of the last great taboos in our society. Domestic violence is about power and control, and to a large extent, sexual abuse is also about power and control and boundaries. And children who have been abused, have been sexually abused, deserve to have guardians who understand what some of the issues may be in their lives, and they deserve to have guardians who can see what's truly happening in the child's life, getting more pieces of that puzzle together to truly protect the child. And so now we've segued directly into the issue of what are some child sexual abuse dynamics and what's the kind of stuff that, that guardians and attorneys need to know about these awful cases. And the one caveat that I'll give you is that this brief training is really just an overview of the dynamics that are discussed much more fully in the online curriculum. So this training, or this little half an hour that, that we're about to jump into, is merely presenting you with that overview and giving you a framework within which to take the rest of the training online. And we know a little bit about how adults learn, and so in that curriculum, we've got learning objectives and quizzes and lots of case examples. There's also some video and some voiceover to try to make this as painless a training as possible, because we know that you all are doing amazing jobs out there, and we hate to burden you with even more responsibility. So I'm hoping that this is an easy way for you to pick up the information you need to help keep kids safe. One of the first things that we learn when presenting the curriculum on child sexual abuse issues is that people have a variety of emotions on a continuum, and even the most unflappable among you, who have, think you have seen everything, and you're pretty steely in your emotions and reserve, can get really flustered, can get really frustrated, can get really disgusted at the cases that come up, the child sexual abuse cases that can come up for you. And the reaction is important to look for, even if you're pretty sure that you are strong enough to be able to deal with these cases. But the disgust, the anger, the anxiety, the depression that staff, that guardians ad litem, that attorneys can have in dealing with these cases does need to be dealt with at the forefront. I mean, even judges should give some thought to their own reactions. You've read about cases in the newspaper. You've had reactions to those things. But when you're dealing with them head on, you deserve to give some thought to your own feelings and your own emotions to be able to get past that and to get into the real concrete things that you're going to do to help protect these kids. So, that being said, when we deal with sexual abuse issues, I want to be sure that you understand that when 39.0139 is triggered, that if the judge does order supervised visitation, I want you to understand that that's sort of the beginning. That's not really the end of the journey. We want to make sure that when we've ordered a child, a family, to supervise visitation, that we don't sort of dust off our hands and say, okay, now that's been taken care of. Because visitation in cases with children who've been sexually abused is fraught with danger. And often the dangers are invisible to people who aren't savvy as to the dynamics. So when we bring a child to supervised visitation, and whether that's going to be by a responsible family member at a supervised visitation program, what we do is we either explicitly or implicitly assure the child that the child is going to be safe, right? This is going to be a safe place. Everything is going to go okay. You are certainly not going to be re-victimized. You're not going to be harmed. No one's going to hurt you, we say in very simple terms. And the problem with that is the fact that we don't want to set up the child. In other words, when a supervisor of a visit then sees a child whom he or she has assured that this is going to be a great visit, this is going to be a time for you to visit with your parent, you are going to be safe during this visit, and when the visit goes the way the supervisor described it, we want to make sure that nobody then jumps to the conclusion that the abuse did not happen. Okay? This is what we call the ethical trap of the good visit. And it's very easy to fall into. And it's very easy to fall into probably because of one of the greatest myths in supervised visitation dynamics, and that's the idea that you can tell whether a person sexually abused a child by looking at them. In other words, if the child reaches with outstretched arms and saying, Mommy or Daddy, and runs to that parent and smiles, that means that the child loves the parent And we know from abuse cases, from neglect cases, from domestic violence cases, we know that the child just wants the abuse to stop or the neglect to stop. The child still loves the parent. But oftentimes in these sexual abuse cases, there's that added level layer of the temptation of saying, aha, it didn't happen. The abuse did not happen. And indeed, there are there's research that basically shows that people think that it's easy to tell whether someone's a sexual offender. And what I need to make sure you know is that child molesters can look like everyone else. They're motivated by a variety of influences. There's no typical child molester, and there is also no test or instrument that reliably determines whether a person has or has not sexually abused a child. And one of the most striking quotes from the research is that the most striking characteristic of sex offenders from a diagnostic standpoint is their apparent normality. So we don't want to set, now we've got this 390139, and so we are going to have a supervised visitation when the parent is not able to rebut the presumption. But you still have to be aware that the fact that everything goes well in supervised visitation, well, according to plan, that no abuse, no overt abuse occurs, does not mean that the child was not sexually abused. So, that's one of the biggest myths. Another myth that you should know about is that the typical sexual abuser is a stranger. We get caught up with the news of horrible crimes that happen against children, and we pay a whole lot of attention to those heinous crimes on TV and in the newspaper. But strangers are sexual offenders in only 8 to 10% of child sexual abuse cases. Right, family members are abusers. The research tells us family members are abusers in about 47% of the cases, and then acquaintances of the child or the child's family is the abuser in approximately 40% of the cases. So we only have a small percentage of cases where it's actually somebody that the child doesn't know. So it's important to understand what some of those myths are to be able to protect kids. The next thing that we want to talk about is the idea of triggers. Remember, we just talked about that the visit may seemingly go well. That is, the child reaches out to the parent, the child wants to interact with the parent, the child smiles, you know, all the indicators, says the right things, you know, mommy, I missed you, daddy, I missed you, that kind of thing. There are ways that a visit supervisor may be blind to what's going on in the visit because they don't understand the concept of triggers. And it's very clear, and we've learned this the hard way in supervised visitation, unfortunately, that the perpetrator of sexual abuse can use the supervised visit, right? And remember, I use the word supervised, can use this visit, even though there's somebody there monitoring the visit, to re-victimize the child or to remind the child of the abuse, of the power that the perpetrator has over the child. And so what we've got is a dynamic where there are things that have gone on that you don't know about, and so you have to start looking for things like, and I'll give you an example, whenever the child shows any discomfort, there may be things like the cologne that the perpetrator is wearing or the jacket that he's wearing that he wore when he abused the child, or a certain song that he sang around the child that the child relates to the abuse experience. We had a supervised visit in a case where a dad brought in a photograph of a camping trip, and it was a lovely photograph. It's the father and the child and the grandfather at a camping trip with the lake in the background. And so the visit supervisor didn't see any reason why the child couldn't see the picture, you know, sort of a reminder of better times in the past. And the child literally began to bang his head against a wall. And we found out later that it was at this camping trip where the grandfather had sexually abused the child. The child actually was harming himself physically. So this was obviously a trigger, and not all triggers are that obvious. But it is something that you have to be aware of, that the perpetrator may try to use some very clever ways to re-victimize the child or to remind the child of the victimization or to control the child. And that's why we say that even when it's supervised, that visitation in child sexual abuse cases is fraught with dangers. And at a very minimum, there need to be very strict rules about the supervisor actually seeing and hearing what's going on at all times, and thus a relative who is likely to leave the room, you know, visitation at a relative's house, say a grandparent. If the grandparent doesn't believe the sexual abuse allegation, then the grandparent is very likely to leave the room, to ignore what's going on, to assume that everything is fine, and still say in good conscience that they think they're supervising that visit. And I know that that may seem intuitive to you because you've dealt with this issue in the past, but in sexual abuse issues, it only takes a second, for a perpetrator to remind a child of the power and control that perpetrator has over that child. Now, how did the perpetrator get that kind of control? You know, how did that happen? This is another thing that adults, educated adults, and that's, you know, guardians and their attorneys, have a really hard time dealing with. How did the child allow this to go on for such a long period of time? The child was not chained to the bedroom. The child was not locked in a closet. The child got up, went to school, interacted with peers, did homework, got good grades or bad grades or whatever. You know, how did it happen that the perpetrator got such control over the child? And this is explained by a really important concept that everybody has to be educated on. And again, it's in the training materials, and there's some case examples there. But the idea is what's called the child abuse accommodation syndrome. And it's really important to understand how sexually abused children learn to cope. And the developer of this theory calls it accommodate, but I like to think of cope as an easier word to understand. So how sexually abused children learned to cope, to deal with their abuse. And the child abuse accommodation syndrome is split up into five categories to kind of parse things out and really explain how this happened, how we got this far, right? How the perpetrator was able to do such terrible things to this child. And of course, it starts with secrecy, that the offender, either overtly or covertly, tells the victim that the sexual behavior is a secret. Okay, so overtly, you can sometimes hear, if you tell, they'll put me in jail. If you tell, I'll kill your mother, right? But in a more covert manner, the offender reminds the victim through words or behavior of the stigma attached with sexual behaviors. Okay, and then the offender can use isolation and intimidation to take advantage of the child's helplessness in the face of this authoritative adult. Okay, so the child then is confused and scared or ambivalent, right? Maybe guilty about enjoying that special attention, the grooming, the massaging, the rubbing up against, the combing of the hair, the physical attention that she or he is receiving from the abuser. She may be frightened, or he may be frightened that something bad's going to happen, if anybody knows. And then there's this compliance. The victim may comply with the abuser's demands out of fear about whatever the consequences of telling are, okay, that they're going to come to pass. So children get that message loud and clear, whether it's spoken loud and clear or not. The next issue is the next category is helplessness. So once the child has either participated in this behavior or experienced this behavior, then the offender is taking advantage of the natural power and authority that adults hold over children. And that's when the victim can hear, nobody's going to believe you, or nobody cares. That feeling of the adult's power and authority makes the victim feel powerless to stop the abuse. Okay, and then the next category is the entrapment and the accommodation. This is the offender is lying, distorting his actions toward the victim. Right, this is something that I'm doing because your mommy won't sleep with me. This is something that all daddies do, or this is something I'm doing to teach you how to be a woman. repeatedly engaging in the sexual victimizing behaviors, and the child is trying to get used to, trying to survive, to accommodate to the abuse. Just, you know, think of it as a survival skill. And so how do you survive? We know this from victims of all types. You survive by denying your feelings, by withdrawing, by denying what's happening, by dissociating from the abuse. So this may explain why some sexually abused kids may interact with an abusive parent at a supervised visitation session in a seemingly appropriate manner. Okay? I'm not going to have to deal with the abuse in this setting because the abuse never occurs in this setting. The abuse only occurs in my house, or the abuse only occurs in his car, or the abuse only occurs somewhere else. And I think I can hear lots of people maybe turning off their phones or hanging up from the phone call. And if before you do that, and I understand that everybody's got really busy schedules, but before you do that, I do want to remind you to please take some time to take this training online if you're going to hang up beforehand, but also to take the training online because there's a lot more online. The next category is the disclosure. And again, I have to remind you that disclosure is generally not an event. It's a process. And this is another thing that adults have to understand, that disclosure of sexual abuse is typically a process. So the offender is going to deny the abuse, right? Calling the victim the liar, saying the victim's mentally ill, or manipulated by the other parent into creating the story. The victim gets threatened, and the child's reaction can be, never mind, right? Can be the child, instead of coming right out and saying something, making a disclosure to a teacher, can drop hints. We hear this all the time, that the child's dropping hints to the non-offending parent or to relatives or friends. And then looking at the reaction. So a guardian may get, and you've probably had these cases before, or some of you on the line have seen these cases where the child discloses. But in a lot of sexual abuse cases, people don't want to believe that it happened. And so it's really dicey for the child to be disclosing to an adult, and the child's looking for that reaction. And if the reaction isn't what the child expected or what the child wanted, boy, the child takes it back. Okay, and that's why there are a few steps forward and then several steps back, and disclosure becomes a process. And that's where we come to the fifth category of the child sexual abuse accommodation syndrome, and that's recanting. So the offender is denying the allegations, convinces the non-offending parent that the abuse didn't occur. This is very difficult, and we're going to spend a minute on talking about non-offending parents and their reactions. But the offender also puts increasing pressure on the child to take it back, okay? Now blaming the victim for problems that are now facing the family because of the disclosure. So not all child victims recant or change their accounts, but some do, and in part because they're not believed, or they're subject to at-home placement, or they're subject to medical exams that are scary, to constant interviews with protective services and law enforcement, and the child faces this deep loss because of the disclosure, right? Loss of peace in his life, loss of his security, his familiar environment, his friends, the family. And so those are the five stages of the child sexual abuse accommodation syndrome, right? So we start with secrecy, helplessness, entrapment and accommodation, disclosure, and then recantation. And I want to say a word about those non-offending parents. Non-offending parents in child sexual abuse cases can be very difficult to deal with because they often have their own issues. There are some studies that have indicated that many non-offending parents in these cases have their own drug and alcohol dependency problems, right? They've suffered heightened levels of depression. You get really high levels of depression in these child sexual abuse cases with the other parent, the non-offending parent. And you've got high levels of anxiety in non-offending parents. Now, these problems may have developed in response to these circumstances, right? Home life is hell, and this non-offending parent may have developed these things in response to these circumstances under which she's resided or he's resided and the abuse occurred. But the clinical research doesn't support the view that the non-offending parent should be blamed for the abuse. Okay, so given that we don't want to do non-offending parent blaming, you know, or victim blaming, you still should be aware of the possible reactions of the non-offending parents. So, first of all, even when there is confirmation of child sexual abuse, you can have a non-offending parent denying that the abuse occurred, right? There's been a big mistake. Trying to convince the guardian, trying to convince the visit monitor, trying to convince the attorney, anybody who will listen, trying to rationalize, it only happened once, minimize. It was only fondling, it could have been much worse. I can control the situation at home. I can make sure that nothing is going to happen any further. The defensiveness, making sure that I'm not blamed for this, it wasn't my fault that it happened. The guilt, the incredible guilt that a non-offending parent can experience, and we go through a visualization exercise with supervised visitation staff about that terrible knock on the door when a hotline call has been made or when investigators show up, and to try to gain some empathy into how parents can feel and how guilty and ashamed and sad and depressed and afraid and angry. And these are the range of reactions that non-offending parents would feel. And some people expect the non-offending parent to immediately take up the banner of the child and say, okay, this has happened, I believe my child, and now we're going to solve this problem. Okay, and that's generally not the way it works. That's generally, typically, parents have a whole lot more of different reactions. And I really liken it to the stages of grief that Kubler-Ross talked about, you know, years ago, that this is they're generally not stages that people go through, but there's some fluidity. People can go back and forth between denial and guilt and ambivalence and anger. And those are the kinds of reactions that you're going to be dealing with the non-offending parent. So hopefully in this short period of time, I've convinced you that even with supervision, even when 390139 kicks in and the judge has determined that a parent has not overcome the presumption of detriment to the child and restricts visitation by ordering that it's supervised, that contact can still be dangerous. All right? And what Sonia had mentioned, that she wanted me to talk briefly about the kinds of training that supervised visitation programs get, Chapter 753 of the Florida Statutes was also amended to require that any supervised visitation program staff who are going to accept these kinds of cases have to have this training. There has to be documentation in their personnel files. And we've been working literally for 3 years, to try to make sure that supervised visitation staff throughout the state have this training. And it is okay for a guardian ad litem or the attorney ad litem or a staff person, before the case gets its first visit at that, you know, the Sunshine Visitation Program, that you ask, when you are aware that these cases, this dynamic exists in this case, it's okay for you to ask, has the staff member or a volunteer or even possibly an intern had this training? So in other words, as you well know, there's a high turnover rate in this service, as there are with many social services. And so it could very well be that a volunteer is going to be monitoring the case. And so it behooves the guardian to ask the question, not just has the staff had this training, but is this particular person who's going to be monitoring this visit with this child and this parent, have they had the training? It's a very fair question to ask, and I would encourage you to hold their feet to the fire on this, because people who haven't, I would argue, and I've said this to supervised visitation staff statewide, if you haven't had the training, you have no business supervising these cases. Now, the law is pretty clear. Legally, you're not supposed to do it. Legally, you can't do it. But it's still worth asking and following up and holding our feet to the fire on that. I think we only have about 5 minutes left, Liz. Is there something else that you would like me to talk about, or did you want to take a question?
Okay, well, I just want to say thank you, and thank you, Karen and Sonia.